The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
A lot of times we'll have two or three men that are in the lot at different times. But of course only one is chosen, usually. And he said, you'll notice that the development of that person who is ordained usually picks up rapidly. The growth of that person picks up rapidly. He says, now, sometimes we would like to think that that growth is a result of the laying on of hands. But as my friend said, he said, more often it's the result of a good kicking the hand. You know, isn't it how we are? When we have to teach something, where do I find sources? Where, you know, and we suddenly get motivated to learn. And when we're given responsibility to teach, it often motivates us. Usually it does. You feel motivated to teach. I once again forgot my stack of books. He made myself a note and see, I forgot it. Try again. I'd like to read from this book here. How many of you have seen this book? A few? It's called Bubblegum and Chalk Dust, Prayers and Poems for Teachers. He sits, the perfect ruffian, chewing the end of his pencil, dropping his pen, often enough to assure him constant attention by his more domesticated peers. He sits, the incarnation of Oliver Twist, Huckleberry Finn, poking with his mutilated yellow eraser the newly assigned pages in his reading book. The end of his nose turns up slightly. His straight yellow hair hangs in uneven, sun-streaked strands. He pushes his pen to the edge of his desk. For an instant, it hangs suspended, then hits the carpet with a dull, familiar thud. Our eyes meet. Mischief dances in his. Determination burns in mine. Howard, do your work. Retrieving his pen, he bows his head in mock obedience. He pushes his stubby finger along the row of black characters. He pokes his broken nail at each word. The room settles into silence. Pages turn with gentle swishes while I attack anew my mountain of ungraded spell. But I look up just in time to see Howard's pen roll slowly, deliberately to the floor. Oh God, I can handle lunchroom food fights, playground fist fights, any open opposition. But what can I do about power? What can I do about its subdued resistance, its lingering persistence in refusing to learn? Dear Lord, help me to be patient, to give even more, and please, don't follow me now, to keep this pen off the floor. Authority in the classroom. Where does authority come from in the classroom? Before I answer that, I'd like to tell you just a few stories. I remember when I was in elementary seeing an older student standing in the hall in a confrontation with the principal. He was wearing one of these big, either red and white or blue and white polka dot hats in the school hall. And he thought it was cool, you know. And I didn't see the beginning of the confrontation, but I remember clearly the look on the student's face. I also remember the look on the principal's face. Neither one was right. The principal was asking if he removed the hat. But neither had the right expression. The student wanted defiance. The teacher, one of grim determination. but not really compassion for the student. Not that every confrontation ought to bring weeping or compassion to our faith, but I think you know what I mean. It was a personal showdown. Okay? It was, who's going to win, eyeball to eyeball? Authority in the classroom. I tell people that if I would have stopped teaching a year ago, I'd have a lot of answers how to run high school. And this year kind of blew me out of the water, because I had a freshman class come in that just blew me out of the water. And speaking about discipline problems, every one of those freshman guys that gave me a lot of trouble, guess what? All five of them had an absentee dad. If not emotionally, if not physically absent, he was emotionally absent. Emotionally, spiritually absent. It was family. And so, you know, we'll talk later about involvement with parents. Crucial. But it's tough when dad's out to lunch. And all five of those guys, the one was a foster, so in that sense, he was in another home. His dad wasn't necessarily out to lunch, but he was still reaping the effects of not having his real dad. It troubled him deeply, constantly. One of those freshmen, late in the year, due to what we had set up, make a long story short, the program we had set up, we had agreed, we sort of had a contract, and he had to meet a certain level of expectations or else be expelled. And late in the year, we did expel him then. But I remember the day that things sort of came to a head, and again, many things, I could spend a whole hour just telling you how to see him through. But I remember the day when I asked him to leave the room, and the defiance I had seen and the disrespect, and I asked him to leave the room, something I'd never done before for any student. And I remember how it affected me. I thought I couldn't talk for a full minute. I was so upset emotionally. I couldn't talk. It seemed like 5 minutes, but it was probably like a minute. And I think of his good friend, who never gave him any trouble in school, and yet this summer told someone that if Mullet would have had half a chance, he'd have kicked me out too. But I didn't like it. I have no idea where to pick that up. But it's real to him. It's real to me. He thinks I don't like him. Authority in the classroom. Ultimately, we know that all authority comes from God. That's where it starts. Romans 13. Other scriptures will tell us that the powers that be are ordained of God. Powers that be are ordained of God. God has given parents authority over their children. He's given the responsibility to teach and train. I almost like that word better than authority. It's given the responsibility to teach and to train. In the Christian school, the parents have delegated that part of that responsibility to us. That's really where your authority comes from. It's from God and parents. They have asked you to become a part of this task of teaching their children, training their children. And because they've asked you, they bring their child to your room. And now you stand in the place of the parent, O Latin and loco parentis. Been around a long time. You stand in the place of the parent to teach your child. I had one first grade teacher who always was obviously uncomfortable with the fact that as a teacher she felt she was in a fishbowl, goldfish bowl, you know. Everybody could see every move. Now, I'd like to read a verse or two in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, where it says, 1 Thessalonians 1, 5, 6, and 7. For our gospel came not unto you in word only, but also in power, and in the Holy Ghost, and in much assurance, as you know what manner of men we were among you for your sake. Paul was in a goldfish bowl. He said, you know what kind of people we were among you. And you became followers of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much affliction with joy of the Holy Ghost, so that ye were examples to all that believe in Macedonia and Achaia. Now, just a couple of things I want to point out there. Paul knew what it was like to live in the fishbowl. And so he said, you know how we lived among you for your sake. Notice he didn't live for his own sake. He wasn't conscious about his own image for his own reputation. He said it was for your sake that we lived that way among you. And I think as a teacher, you need to live for this, live that way for the sake of your students. It's what we talked about, that life is too short, people are too precious to be right all the time, to have to, I am in charge here. See, I don't want that mentality at all as a teacher, even though it's true. But that's not where I start. I live among my students for their sakes. That's the reason. And notice the result of that kind of life. In verse 7, it says, and so you became a model to all the believers. You were examples. You became a model to all the believers. The result, I believe, of godly authority in the classroom. Paul did it with integrity. Paul did it with integrity. First Thessalonians 2, the next chapter. Paul goes on and he describes some of the ways that he lived among them. And I'd like to read this, especially in light of thinking of yourself in leadership. And I see leadership as servanthood. You're there leading out so that other people can become all the way. I tell my students, I say, school is the only place where people are paid to help you become all that you can possibly become. Now you think about it. No other time in your life is everybody around you paid to help you become all that you can become. And that ought to be your mission as a teacher. To help your students become all that they can possibly become. So, leadership, servanthood, helping people. Chapter 2. I'm going to read this and just point out different things as we go. I'm going to read this in the NIV. I want to be sensitive. I don't know how you feel about other versions, translations. But sometimes I think it's refreshing to read it in a different version. It says, you know, brothers, and I think it's beneficial to follow along, even if you have King James. I like following along in another version. You know, brothers, that our visit to you was not a failure. We had previously suffered and been insulted in Philippi, as you know. But with the help of our God, we dared to tell you this gospel, in spite of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives. Notice his motivation. Nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as men approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Another person was telling over the weekend that his supervising teacher kept a list of all the names and phone numbers of his worst students in all his classes. And when he wasn't getting cooperation, he'd pull out the list and say, hey, you recognize that number? What was his motivation? His method was manipulation. Paul said we weren't like that. On the contrary, we speak as men approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We are not trying to please men, but God. There's a second important concept. You're not trying to please men. You're not trying to become the best friend of those students. But you're trying to please God. Remember, you're there for them, not for your sake, not so you can feel good, but you're there for them. He says, you know, okay, let me finish that. We are not trying to please men, but God who tests our hearts. Verse 5, you know, we never use flattery, nor did we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We were not looking for praise from men, not from you or anyone else. As apostles of Christ, we could have been a burden to you, but we were gentle among you, like a mother caring for her little children. Now Paul goes, and he makes some comparisons here to the parent as to how he treated the people there at Thessalonica. He said, notice, we were like a mother caring for her little children. What kind of care is that? You watch a mother. Amazing amount of patience. Amazing amount of affection. Notices the little needs. Understands the motivations for the fits. They know. They understand why it's going on, generally. Like a mother, caring for little children. We loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Personality and character. Because you had become so dear to us. We loved those people. Surely you remember, brothers, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. Notice that his life matched his word. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children. Now we have the father. How's that? Encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God. You know, something about a father who draws us out of ourselves. A father generally pushes us out of our comfort zone. A mother is often the one who nurtures and cares and supports in, you know, so you scrape your knee on, you know, and the father should be able to do that too, but you understand what I'm saying. The mother is often the one who does this sort of thing. Whereas a father says, now I want you to go. And a father urges, exhorts people to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. And here's the result of this kind of leadership. And we also thank God continually because when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you accepted it not as the word of men, but as it actually is, the word of God, which is at work in you who believe. I just think it's so important that you see yourself in the proper framework as a teacher. I want to talk about levels of leadership and how leadership develops. How many of you are going to be teaching your first year this fall? Okay. I want to talk about some levels of leadership. You agree to teach this year. This is your first year. And you now have the title of teacher. Right? You're now going to be, I don't know what your school uses, either Miss or Mr. or Brother or Sister or whatever you use for titles in your school. You are a teacher. That's a title. And that's the first level of leadership is position. Position. That's the first and most obvious level of leadership, is position. This could be known as the right level of leadership. When you open your class the first day of school, those students will listen to you because you are the teacher. They don't know you. properly, very well, at least not as a teacher. If you're a first-year teacher, that's their first day in your room. They don't know the teacher, so they're sitting there watching. You know, they're taking an awful lot in. They're not just taking in the color of the walls. You know, they're taking a lot in about you. That's what makes sort of the first day so nerve-wracking. But they're taking an awful lot in. And at that point, with them, I want you to keep in mind all that we've talked about today so far about personality and character. With them, you have only a position, teacher. That's it. And on that basis, you have the right, in their minds, you have the right to ask them to sit quietly and to take out their books, open your books. This is your notebook for the year. This is your issue of the pencil sharpener is, and so on. And they'll listen to you. They follow you because they have to. They don't have much choice, do they? They follow you because they have to. You're the teacher. And once you leave, they won't follow you after you leave, if that's all that you are to them, is a teacher. Position, a teacher. The second level of leadership has to do with permission. And a key word here would be relationships. Here, people follow because they want to. Now, what would make them want to follow you? Now, there's going to be a few students in your room who will want to follow you from day one because they like to be in with the person in charge. You know those people. They're just good from day one, and they just get right next to you because they want to please you. They want to please you. And you don't have to do anything for them. They just want to please you. And you don't have to get heavily involved in their life for them to be completely content in your class. They want your attention, but they want to please you because you're the teacher. Here is where people go the second mile because you show that you care about them. Remember about permission? They give you permission. Remember, as a teacher, you have the right to say, take out your books. But I'm guessing you don't have the right to say, that's a good example, to say, I don't like your glasses. That's out of your realm, right? As a teacher, isn't it? Now, mom and dad would say, I don't like your glasses. The child would respond completely differently than if you were to say, I don't like your glasses. That's a poor example. I hope that communicates the point. You don't have the right, as a teacher, to do that. But if you get to know the student, and you've taken some time to talk to the student, you've begun to, you know their name, and you know a little bit about their family, and you kind of stay up with what's happening, and the student tells them, I'm going to get new glasses. No. And so they come the next day and they say, what do you think? Yeah, they're okay. You know, they look nice. You know, don't you like, well, you know, you could, depending on the motion, you could get by with saying, well, you know, I think it could be nice, your glasses. Let's not run this analogy too far. Okay? My point is that you have permission, though, to turn around, because the student, because you have gotten involved with the student, you have gotten some permission to get involved with their life, because you showed you cared about them. You've gotten involved. And so you had some permission. It goes back to this whole idea, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. You know, if they know you care about them, you can get by with an awful lot. And here is where you walk the halls and you know people's names, and you walk the halls and you pray for students, and you spend time praying, that we talked about earlier. This is the level where you begin to develop permission, and people will give you permission to touch them at a deeper level. A third level of leadership. Key word here could be production or results. Production or results. Students begin to describe you in terms of what you have done for them. You know what, since I've had this teacher, I've been able to overcome this problem, I've been able, I, I've I'm reading two grades higher in my level. Well, I didn't used to be able to read, and since this teacher came and she put in the time and she cared about me, and I can read a lot better. I don't have to be scared about telling people what books I read, you know. You understand what I'm saying? You have done something. You've produced some results because of your involvement in the life of the student. There are some results in that life. And they begin to describe you in terms of what you have done. You are known because of what you have achieved. And you begin, at this level, to build a high morale in your classroom. Because people know that you've done something. Students know you've done something. And they know you care about them. And you've gone the second mile with them. And they're willing to go the second mile with you. And your number one priority at this level is to maintain good relationships with students. You cannot afford adversarial relationships with students. It's one of the problems we have in teaching, isn't it? It almost implies an adversarial relationship. I teach, you learn. And you need to listen to me teach. And it almost produces an adversarial, it's a problem that's discussed in research sometimes. How do you deal with this problem? You need to be sensitive to it. That's why it's so important that you communicate to the student, I am for you. I am for you. I tried in my school, I always felt like it took me a year or two to even begin to get to know the freshman class very well. You know, they first came in, they didn't know what they expected of me. They were sensitive about being the youngest in the class, and they didn't want to be pushy, and they felt intimidated by the seniors. And I even had a class two of seniors early on that made sure that they stayed intimidated, you know. Reminded them frequently of their junior status, you know. Well, so it took freshmen, they didn't know how to take me. They had just had a great teacher 2 years before in their minds, and they just got to know him real well, and then they had to move on. And so it took a year or two. Because the other reason was because I spent much more time with the upper level grades because of yearbook, newspaper, and graduation coming on. And we have small groups that meet once a week, and I meet with those group leaders. And so I had a lot more involvement with the older students. And they would see that. And they would, you know how you are. When you see someone else with a good relationship, you know, you don't infringe on that. You're not going to step in there. I don't belong there. And so they would respect that distance, and it took some time to build relationships. But I decided that if I could pour into my older students, and I, of course, tried as soon as they came to my room in ninth grade, but it takes time to build that relationship. But I decided if I could pour in to my older students, if I could help them become what they really wanted to become. You know, most people want to go somewhere. They just need some help knowing how to get there. And if you can help them get there, they will love you for life. Now, you don't do it for selfish reasons. You don't do it for your love. You do it for your help. But what I'm saying is that I figured if I could pour into my older students and really help them get somewhere, I knew that morale would trickle down to the freshmen. And the freshmen would also want that kind of relationship with the teacher. And so I think it's important that we are aware. And then what happened in my small groups was that I began to teach and to train those seniors in those small groups. They could begin to teach and train freshmen. And they would go to bat for me with discipline problems. They went to bat for me with this guy expelled. He made a statement one time. I wasn't going to let him help in a choir program until he made a statement to the rest of high school because of all the belligerence that he was displaying. And I didn't think he was going to do it. I told him I didn't want to force it. I said, I want to be honest. But he made a beautiful statement to the high school one evening for a program. And then we split up for a time of prayer. And that evening, I don't know why I did it. I didn't usually. I just said, why don't you split up into your small groups if we don't have normally during the week. And but his small group leader was a senior, very committed guy, sharp, loved people, felt he could identify with some of the struggles this freshman guy was having. And he told me later, he said, hey, well, we really poured on that guy. We surrounded him, we told him we thought it was great, we thought it was a big breakthrough for him, and we told him we loved him, we hugged him, we prayed with him. And that's the kind of support I got from that senior. See, invaluable. But the first year, guess what? That freshman that was now a senior, he didn't like me. So he didn't like me. I had to earn the right to be heard from him. Okay, so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. When you want to develop people, you want to help people get somewhere. Young people want to grow. They want to get somewhere. And if you can help them, they will really support you. The fourth level would be called people development. I've been discussing that a little bit with that senior. It's where you reproduce. People development is where you reproduce. Here, people follow because of what you have done for them personally. Third level, they talked about results. Could be personal or otherwise, but on the fourth level, they follow because of what you have done for them personally. They say, hey, he or she, they really helped me. I'll never forget what they did for me that one day. And they're great. And I've seen those people stand in a group where there's been criticism of the person who helped them, and they will stick up to their peers for that authority figure, simply because they're loyal, because that person has gone the second mile and helped them grow in the Lord, in their personal life. Well, there's other levels we could talk about, but I think those are the ones that are most pertinent to our teaching. I'd like to talk a little bit now about motivation, and I hope to bring this all together here at the end. Motivation. What motivates people? Lots of examples. I think, Edward, you mentioned the other day that a young boy who came to you crying. He said, ever since I was a little boy, I've always wanted to do bad things. And he was crying. Why did God make me this way? Ever since I remember, I'm always in trouble. I just want to do bad things. What motivates him? You ever think about trying to dip your finger in his heart and see what's there? And see if you couldn't touch what was motivating him? I think Edward said he's 32 now, he's still a problem. Messed up. I had one of my freshmen tell me this year that, I just always feel like I want to just do something, I just want to do something. I just don't feel like being good. Isn't that interesting? But there's two kinds of needs. There's at least two kinds of needs that we could talk about today. There's felt needs. In other words, needs are on the conscious level. Needs that we feel and think about and are aware of. Felt needs. And then we have real needs. You know, and in one sense, we could kind of say that the felt needs are up on the waterline. These are the ones we're aware of. The real needs are down below the surface. And we're not always aware of the real needs, especially children. They don't understand everything that makes them tick the way they do. They just, they just know they got in trouble. And how are you going to help them? Motivation. Well, your task as a teacher is to take those real needs and surface them. Bring them to the surface. That's your task as a teacher. So they become felt needs. There's two ways that we do that. Two ways that we bring real needs to the surface and make so they become felt needs. One is by Scripture. We open the Word and we begin to talk about their heart, talk about what God says about who they are. The second thing that we do is we create felt needs by experience. We use experiences to make them aware. And we talk about those when someone comes up and corners you about why you do what you do. You may not have really thought about the fact that you should understand why you believe the way you believe. But suddenly that real need becomes a felt need where it wasn't felt before. And so experience is the way we do it. And another way that we do is we develop by developing responsibility with accountability. Responsibility with accountability. In other words, I want you to go do that, and when you're done, I'm going to come check it out. I'm going to look at it. You're going to hold them accountable. And so that develops motivation. Now, the more they invest, the greater they'll be interested. The more they invest, the greater they'll be interested. You know, someone has said that America puts 19-year-old boys on $50 million aircraft, and they fly them successfully. But those same boys come into our churches, and we don't even let them take up the offer. I think the same can be true of our students. We sometimes want to keep them at a point where they really need us to survive, to make it. And we need to develop in them a desire, an ability to do these things, to be the person they need to be because of internal desire. Well, there's a lot more. I would talk about motivation, but we need to move on. I want to put this together now in terms of how we go about setting up discipline in the classroom. And I think there's so many factors that enter in here. A lot of things we can talk about, you know, in terms of authority in the classroom. Let me just read you some statistics. 1 out of 9 children comes from a chemically dependent home. 1 out of 13 are sexually abused. Every 90 minutes, a teenager commits suicide. Every 90 minutes, a teenager commits suicide. Every 30 seconds, an adolescent girl becomes pregnant. Every 30 seconds, that blows your mind. And you know, these people, if we see them, they're obnoxious. Put it in strong terms, they are obnoxious to us. I mean, you know, there's just not much there that really draws us to them, unless we have the heart of God for them. Someone has said that the obnoxious qualities in people are really just cries for help. And again, I think we have to have that attitude as a foundation for the way we discipline in the classroom. We don't go in there to run something my way, and it's going to happen this way, and I want these certain things to happen. I don't care how anybody feels or what's happened in anybody's life today. This has to happen. Well, we do have time pressure. We have lesson plans. We have curriculum. We have the end of the year coming up. We have all those things, but remember, people are still the most important. So that when you discipline, people are the most important, not your schedule, not your books, not your lesson plan, but people. People are the most important. In 10 years, remember, they're not going to remember what you taught. They're going to remember who you are. You may have heard this statement as well. You love Jesus only as much as the person you love the least. I never had liked that statement. You love Jesus only as much as the person you love the least. Well, let's look at some myths of discipline. Here's a book that I would recommend for reading. Probably the area I felt the least equipped in school was in classroom management, discipline. And I think we all have misconceptions about authority, about how to relate to people when they misbehave, when they don't do as they're supposed to do. And this book, what they did, they wrote like 200 and some school administrators and said, give us the names and addresses of your master teacher. You know, some people can just step into a classroom and they just seem gifted. That's a small percentage. Most of us need some help in learning how to discipline, how to manage a classroom. Some people can walk in and they'll just make it happen. But most of us need some help. And what they did with those master teachers, they sent them a long survey and they said, what are your biggest problems in the classroom? How do you deal with them? What's your perspective on why they're there? And this book, in a very readable format, takes that research and puts it and organizes it. Let me just see if I can read you some of the titles. We talk about discipline by design. In other words, you don't just go in and say, well, you know, if you're going to listen, I'm going to teach. You know, here goes nothing. And they talk about the myths of discipline. They talk about the parent connection. They talk about corporal punishment. They talk about classroom standards, routine problems. And then they break these five top problems. They break them down. They analyze it. They describe them. They look at why they're there. Look at why those teachers thought they were there, and then how to handle it, how to deal with it. And it's not set in stone. There's latitude for you to put your own ideas and things in, but it really gives you a great format, great structure to set up your own classroom management program. So I'm just going to be sharing some things out of this book. One of the things that they talk about are the myths of discipline. An old cartoon they have here that I think is funny and yet sobering because it's right. You'll find the book, Classroom Discipline of Three Easy Lessons, in the fiction section. You're not going to find it in Three Easy Lessons. It's not going to happen easily. If you've taught, you know that. It's not easy. So here's myth number one. You learn it on the job. Myth number one of classroom management, classroom discipline, is that you learn it on the job. You're not going to learn it on the job. Now, there is an element of truth to this. Remember, we talked about experience being the best teacher. You learn a lot on the job. But it needs to be evaluated. Myth number two. The ability to discipline is a gift. That's what a lot of us would like to believe. Well, I love to teach, but discipline is just not my thing, you know? And we'd like to think that we could pass it off as that. But it is not a gift. Some people are gifted with the ability to make things run smoother. But you can learn to have a good, disciplined classroom. Myth number three, if you are a good teacher, you won't have discipline problems. Trust me, there's always one or two that will test you to the max, no matter how good you are. You know, we describe teachers sometimes as good teachers or bad teachers. There's an element of truth to that, but labels are tough. Remember, the complex skills are not easily learned, especially the skills of managing an entire classroom full of young people so that they all simultaneously forsake the joys of goofing off for the rigors of learning. I mean, what do we expect? Myth number four, the longer you teach, the better at discipline you become. You know, there's always a situation with a new twist on it. At least it was for me. I could never relax, sit on my laurels. Research indicates that by the fifth year of teaching, the vast majority of teachers have developed a predictable pattern for classroom management. This same research also indicates that during the first 5 years of teaching, teachers will potentially face nearly 85% of all the types of classroom problems they will ever encounter. The conclusions drawn from the research are clear. Number one, the types of discipline problems encountered by experienced teachers will not be much different than those experienced by teachers during the first 5 years. Two, longevity in the classroom does not necessarily ensure the increased effectiveness of classroom management. In other words, if you never get help, if you never want help in managing that classroom better, you could go through. I had a substitute teacher in public school one time. We all knew her. And she was full of threats. She'd walk in. Substitute teaching was hard anyway, by the way. This is third and fourth grade, and we had her wrapped around a little finger. She would get down, and she would nearly yell. She would yell, "Do you want me to take you to the principal's office?" And a student, well, they're having the time of their life, you know? Oh. Well, if you don't put that right now, I'll take you, you know. You can get everybody sitting there. It was crazy. It was terrible. That's the way it was. That's the way she always did it. Her name was Mrs. Lovely. Experience is only a good teacher when we determine to pay heed to the lessons to be learned. You need to be willing to learn from your mistakes and make mid-course corrections. Myth number five is just the class that I have this year. Well, it's just this bad class. That's what I would have liked to think last year. I've got a tough class. It's a good time to take off for here too. I had said I'd take off before that class ever came in. Myth number six, good control depends on finding the right gimmick. It's not a gimmick, folks. Teachers do not realize that relatively little student misbehavior is spontaneous, the product wholly of the moment. Now, they're just goofing off. They're just good children, teenagers. Administering discipline is a more laborious task than...
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.